This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 29th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, efforts to pass an international arms trade treaty are blocked at the UN after North Korea, Iran, and Syria mount protests of the deal. The EPA's plan to reduce air pollution by cracking down on toxins in gasoline prompts fierce lobbying efforts by the oil and gas industry. And we'll hear voices from the nation's capital after a historic week for LGBTQ rights.
My partner and I are out here today to show our support and to fight for our right to get married and for me to be able to stay in the United States.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. North Korean and U.S. military maneuvers have created increased geopolitical tension on the Korean Peninsula. State media of North Korea reports leader Kim Jong-un has ordered missiles put into standby position. This comes a day after the U.S. military conducted training exercises with stealth bomber aircraft over South Korea. While it could be bellicose political posturing by both sides, it's been sufficient to prompt declarations from regional giants Russia and China. In Pakistan, a suicide bomber killed at least 7 people in the city of Peshawar. The attack was apparently aimed at a regional police official and occurred near the area's U.S. consulate. The police commander was reportedly unharmed. At least a dozen bystanders were wounded in the attack. This was the third bombing in the region in the span of a week. Multiple car bomb attacks outside 5 Shiite mosques in Iraq have killed at least 18 people and wounded more than 70 others. The explosives were timed to coincide with the end of Friday prayers at 4 mosques in Baghdad and another in the northern city of Kirkuk. As of deadline, no group had claimed responsibility for the attacks. As the U.S. Congress prepares to debate immigration reform, immigrant groups and their allies gathered on the New Haven Green for a ceremony to mark Good Friday and call for an end to deportations which divide families. Melinda Tuhus reports.
As church bells rang at noon on Good Friday, Christians and people of other faiths gathered on the New Haven Green for a service called Deportation Crucifies, a Good Friday liturgy for memory and hopes. 2 undocumented immigrants who are members of Unidad Latina en Acción spoke about their own suffering at the hands of immigration authorities and unscrupulous employers. Then 7 clergy members of various Christian denominations gave brief sermons. The Reverend Jerry Streets is pastor of one of the oldest African-American congregations in the country, Dixwell United Church of Christ. He said those coming to this country as immigrants act out of trust and hope and surrender.
And we as a nation have to have policies and an attitude whereby we are able to receive them in a welcoming way so that they can reach their potential as human beings as Christ died for us to reach ours.
After the service, participants placed dozens of white crosses on the green to honor the memory of immigrants who died coming to the U.S. Organizers called for unity to push through immigration reform where all residents of the U.S., native-born or not, receive equal treatment. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New Haven.
Attorneys for a Yemeni prisoner participating in a long-running hunger strike at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility have filed an emergency motion claiming Musab Omar al-Madwani and other prisoners have been denied access to potable water. In response, Colonel John Bogdan, the commander in charge of Guantanamo Bay Guards, filed an affidavit stating all detainees have, quote, unlimited access to potable water from taps in sinks in their cells and on the detention blocks. Accounts about the actual conditions inside of Camp 6 differ significantly between the attorneys for the detained and the military, as do the reported numbers of prisoners participating in the hunger strike. Meanwhile, a team from the International Red Cross has arrived at the detention facility to evaluate conditions. The Environmental Protection Agency released a new study this week showing that the majority of the rivers and streams in the United States are in jeopardy. More than half suffer from too much pollution to sustain healthy aquatic life. Molly Stenz has the story from WORT in Madison.
The EPA calls it one of their most comprehensive surveys on the nation's flowable waters. They sampled water from 2,000 sites across the country and had scientists analyze the nutrients and animal life within. And what they found were rivers and streams that are not healthy. Denise Keener, director of the EPA's Office of Wetlands, Oceans, and Watersheds, led the agency's effort.
Nationally, what we found was that 55% of our nation's river and stream miles are in what we would categorize as poor biological condition. And what that means is that they don't support healthy populations of aquatic life.
More than a quarter of the nation's rivers have excessive levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, pollution often caused by fertilizer runoff, concentrated sewage discharge, or animal waste from factory farms. They also found fish with potentially unsafe levels of mercury in more than 13,000 miles of rivers. The survey is in draft form and is open for public comment through May 9th. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Despite overwhelming support for the historic UN arms trade treaty, Iran, North Korea, and Syria blocked the measure, preventing consensus among the 193 member states. The treaty is meant to regulate the global trade of conventional arms, and while the final draft did prompt some objections, most countries were willing to vote for it. Proponents of the treaty still hope it will be passed by a two-thirds majority in the UN General Assembly. FSRN's Salim Rizvi reports from the United Nations.
After several years of discussions, global leaders were finally at the cusp of unanimously approving the first international treaty to regulate global arms trade and prevent illicit transfer and diversion of conventional arms. But it took just three countries to prevent it from happening. Iran, North Korea, and Syria blocked the treaty by objecting to different provisions they deem unsuitable for their countries. For example, Syria said the treaty fails to ban weapon sales to groups that commit, quote, acts of aggression, a reference to the rebel groups fighting against the government. Many countries, rights groups, and NGOs expressed frustration that Syria, Iran, and North Korea would block such an important treaty that would save lives and reduce violence. Anna McDonald is the head of arms control of a non-governmental organization, Oxfam.
It's outrageous that three countries have held up these negotiations and prevented an historic agreement being agreed today. 190 countries would have been happy to see the arms trade treaty agreed today, which will prevent arms getting into the hands of human rights abusers and warlords. It's long overdue. One person dies every minute as a result of armed violence. Millions of more see their lives shattered and torn apart by an arms trade that is out of control. We must have an arms trade treaty.
Several countries that said the treaty was not strong enough still voted for it. India said the treaty is weak on the issue of terrorism and fails to include provisions on non-state actors. Even the United States, which had stalled previous negotiations and objected to regulate ammunitions, voted for it. Tom Countryman is the head of the U.S. delegation at the Arms Trade Treaty Conference.
2 weeks of hard negotiations produced a text that was balanced, that was effective, and that was meaningful and implementable. A text that did not in any way touch upon the constitutional rights of American citizens. A text that the United States supported. We look forward to the adoption of this text by the General Assembly in the very near future.
Under the treaty, the sale of arms will be barred if the exporting country knows the weapons are to be used for violating human rights or repression and violence against women and children. Rights groups and advocates of arms control also say the final treaty is much better than the previous drafts, including banning human rights violators from getting arms transfers. Whitney Brown is the senior director of international law and policy at Amnesty International.
In Article 7, one of the key things that every state must assess before they okay a transfer is the likelihood that those weapons would be used to commit serious violations of human rights. Bahrain's a really good example. The U.S. is one of the largest suppliers to Bahrain, and we know, we've seen the Bahrain security forces turn on peaceful protesters and shoot them. From the point of view of this treaty, any further arms transfer to Bahrain would be prohibited. Now, of course, what we know is that the U.S. has the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain. So whether in the end, on a case-by-case basis, they're going to honor both the letter of the treaty and the spirit of the treaty remains to be seen. Part of why civil society will continue to play an important role in making sure this treaty is well implemented.
The treaty covers the transfer of tanks, armored combat vehicles, large caliber artillery systems, combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, missiles and missile launchers, along with small and light arms. But the treaty doesn't include drones and grenades. Imports of arms are also not regulated under this treaty. Some civil society groups say despite deficiencies, the treaty is a good start, which can always be improved upon. Pafur Amoa is the president of West African Action Network on Small Arms.
If one looks at it from the point of view that the way United Nations processes operate, it doesn't take a short time to have agreement on a number of things. So once we have a UN convention on register on conventional arms, it is easier to start with that. And hopefully, if the treaty comes to force, then we believe that the state parties will be able to add on whenever they want in their amendment conferences. Where now they will require 3/4 of the parties present and voting.
The Arms Trade Treaty is expected to be put to vote in the UN General Assembly next week, where it could pass with a 2/3 majority. To go into effect, a minimum of 50 countries would need to sign and ratify the treaty. Many proponents of the treaty hope it will help regulate the $70 billion global arms trade, reducing illegal arms transfers, and resulting in less killings, repression, and gender-based violence. Salim Rizvi, FSRN, at the United Nations.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a plan today to cut down on sulfur and nitrogen oxides in gasoline, which it calculates will significantly reduce air pollution, prevent thousands of premature deaths and illnesses, and make new cars and trucks sold in the country more efficient. But oil and gas corporations are mobilizing a lobbying blitz to delay or kill this and other environmental regulations. In Washington, D.C., FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The EPA's new draft rule strengthens existing controls on the pollution that comes out of the tailpipes of cars and trucks, namely sulfur, nitrogen oxides, volatile organic compounds, carbon monoxide, benzene, and fine particles, all of which create the familiar smog and soot that blankets many major cities. Luke Tonichel with the Natural Resources Defense Council says both oil and gas corporations and car manufacturers will have to make changes to comply with the rule starting in 2017.
The fuel providers, the oil industry, would, in some of their refineries, many of their refineries already meet the requirements, put in some processes to take that sulfur out. And the automakers need to optimize their exhaust systems to reduce those pollutants from the tailpipe.
The agency estimates that once the rule is fully implemented, the reduced emissions will save up to 2,400 premature deaths every year. Janice Nolan with the American Lung Association says that's a conservative estimate. Based on studies by her organization, the rule could have a far greater impact in preventing death and illness, especially in children.
When we're born, we still have about 80% of our lungs to develop, and they continue to grow until we're teenagers and are fully grown. So most of your lungs actually came into being after you were breathing all the air that you have in your community. So children are exposed to more pollution too because they're often more active. They're playing outside more, and it's the kind of impact that may happen in their childhood but could affect the way their lungs develop that could impact them the rest of their lives. It could put them at higher risk of developing lung diseases later on, for example.
The new standards will save the country between $8 and $23 billion in annual health costs, according to the EPA's calculation. Nolan says the changes will have the biggest impact on the health of people living near busy highways, which have higher levels of these dangerous pollutants.
And we do find people who live near these major highways or in big urban areas are often more likely low income. And low income people are more harmed by pollution. Sometimes it's because they live near a major road or near a source of pollution, and sometimes it's because they have less access to care.
Though California and nearly a dozen other states voluntarily adopted these cleaner gasoline standards last year, the fossil fuel industry is mobilizing to delay their national implementation. Representatives from American Fuel and Petroleum Manufacturers and the American Petroleum Association, as well as several members of Congress who've received large donations from these industries, have spoken out against the rule. Chair of the Energy and Power Subcommittee introduced a bill last year to stop the agency from moving forward with this proposal. And several Congress members wrote the president this year asking for a delay. Their main argument is that it will cost refineries too much money to convert to cleaner fuel, a cost that could be passed on to consumers. But the NRDC's Tonichel says the industry has used the same lobbying and messaging tactics to oppose nearly all past environmental regulations, yet their warnings have not proven accurate.
I think we've seen in many regulatory areas where the industry overestimates the cost of compliance just because, you know, they're heavily focused on their profits. But yet when it comes down to having a standard, they innovate to meet that standard and costs typically come in much lower than the original estimates.
The EPA estimates that the rules will only cost refiners 1 penny per gallon of gas and will increase the price of the average car by $130. Once the proposal is published in the Federal Registry in the next few weeks, the agency will hold a 30-day public comment period and several public hearings before proposing a final rule. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
I'm Ralph Nader. Why do we need Free Speech Radio News? With 200 reporters over six continents giving you the reality of the world, and not taking any corporate money? The answer is in the question. If you really want to learn about what's going on in terms of the brutality around the world, the power of militarism and empire, how people are trying to preserve the planet from climate change to environmental improvement for farmers and consumers and workers, if you want to learn more about what people are really doing to fight back, people who are suffering but not giving up, you will listen to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News cannot exist without your support. That's what makes it honest. The contact for your support, fsrn.org. Let's remember that, fsrn.org. They're waiting for your collaboration.
State lawmakers in Georgia passed a bill Thursday that will modify certain aspects of a controversial law on immigration called HB 87 that drew criticism and court challenges after it was signed into law in 2011. Georgia's House and Senate both voted to approve Senate Bill 160. Representative Dustin Hightower, who sponsored the bill in the House, said it aims to respond to state agencies that said that the two-year-old law made it difficult to process public benefits, including professional licenses, to immigrants. But immigration advocacy groups say lawmakers added amendments that include further restrictions for undocumented people. The amendments could affect access to driver's licenses and obtaining basic documents such as marriage licenses. For more, we're joined by Azadeh Shahshahani, attorney with the ACLU of Georgia. She joins us from Atlanta. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for having me.
So one of the amendments that passed would make it a crime for state and local government officials to accept foreign passports as proof of ID without further documentation. What are the implications of this?
So right now, a foreign passport is the only document that undocumented immigrants can use in order to prove their identity. And this is because the legislation that passed in 2011, the Arizona copycat law, prevented undocumented immigrants from using a variety of documents that they used to be able to use. So when this legislation attempted to cut out foreign passports, as it has now done, from the listing of documents that undocumented immigrants would be able to use for a variety of official transactions, it was a real concern to us. And the implications of this have yet to be seen. We will obviously monitor the situation very closely to ensure that immigrant communities in our state are not harmed and are not cut off from basic and humanitarian necessities.
As you say, it remains to be seen exactly how this plays out, but some people have expressed concern that the ability to obtain some basic documents such as marriage certificates could be affected. Is that a possibility?
Sure. You know, I should mention that the right to marry is a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution, and it has been recognized by federal courts that that is in fact the case. And so we will monitor the situation closely, and if we find out about cases that undocumented immigrants and their prospective spouses are being prevented this right to marry, we will definitely challenge that practice.
There's another amendment that could potentially block the lawfully present immigrants to obtain driver's licenses. Now, this is also an issue that's being taken up in other areas of the country. In Arizona, there's a lawsuit seeking to block Governor Jan Brewer's action to deny driver's license. In Georgia, how could this amendment play out?
Actually, last year, the Attorney General in Georgia stated that young people granted deferred action should be able to receive driver's licenses, and that has been the case in Georgia. So we do hope that that continues, and if not, again, that is something that we have to look to closely to ensure that immigrants who are present here lawfully and are allowed by the federal government to live and work here are also allowed the ability to have a driver's license.
And again, one group that could potentially be affected are those who are qualified for the deferred action on deportation. That was got a lot of attention from the Obama administration on immigration last year.
Exactly.
Well, to take a step back for a moment and see how this bill, the Senate Bill 160, came about. Originally, according to the one of the co-sponsors, Representative Dustin Hightower, the original intent of the bill was to facilitate people to obtain and keep a professional license in a much easier fashion. And that was a response to some of the criticism of the original legislation. So how did this come about?
Exactly. And, you know, that was an initiative that we were all in support of, fixing at least one problem with the Arizona copycat law that passed in Georgia. And then all of a sudden we were presented with a totally different version of the legislation, creating all of these additional burdens and complications, and obviously with the intent of further cracking down on immigrant communities in our state. You know, there's been this push and this drive for the past few years to make immigrants' lives in our state so difficult so that they would leave the state. Obviously, our economy, the agricultural industry, also suffered greatly as a result. And so, again, what we saw happen with this bill is that it got hijacked by those with an anti-immigrant agenda, where we had thought that the leadership in Georgia had understood that anti-immigrant legislation is not good for Georgia. We have to be welcoming the immigrant communities, but unfortunately that was not the case.
Azadeh Shashahani is an attorney with the ACLU Georgia. She joined us for an update on the HB 87 and amendments that are part of the Senate Bill 160 that were passed this week. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This week was a historic one in the movement for LGBTQ rights. The Supreme Court heard arguments Tuesday on the constitutionality of Proposition 8, the 2008 California ballot initiative that banned same-sex couples from getting married. Wednesday, the justices were presented with cases for and against the Defense of Marriage Act, which prohibits the federal government from recognizing same-sex marriages that are legal in 9 states and the District of Columbia. And Thursday, Daniel Choi, the Army lieutenant who was discharged from the military under the now repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, was found guilty for his role in a November 2010 protest outside the White House. The federal court fined him $100. While the Supreme Court proceedings were underway, thousands of people gathered on Capitol Hill to rally in support of equal rights for people of all sexual orientations. FSRN reporter Anna Simonton spoke to demonstrators and brings us this edition of Street Beat.
Today is Bonnie and my 31st anniversary, this actual day. So we decided the fact that the DOMA oral arguments were today was a sign and that we should come down here and observe our anniversary.
My partner and I are out here today to show our support and to fight for our right to get married and for me to be able to stay in the United States. I think it's something like 40 or 50,000 couples, binational couples, in the 10 American states that allow gay marriage now, that are married or about to get married, but who are not able to stay within the United States because DOMA prevents immigration law from allowing a gay person to sponsor a green card for their spouse.
I hopped to 4:40 a.m. at a Penn Station this morning to be here. My wife of only 2 months is currently deployed overseas, and she's a captain of the Marine Corps. We've been together for 9 years, and with the passing of marriage equality in New York, that was a fantastic beginning, but obviously because of DOMA, there are many different incentives as a military spouse and as a couple that we are unfortunately denied. So I'm here to help fight for housing allowance and help to fight for medical and dental insurance and death benefits. And damn it, I want a military ID to get on that base. That's why I'm here.
Rob and I are planning to retire, but we ask ourselves, what will happen should one of us become ill, disabled, or God forbid, die? Illness, disability, and death could spell disaster simply because our marriage is not recognized. We should have the same rights and benefits that every other legally married couple in this country enjoys and counts on in tough times.
I'm here to help to support my moms.
I'm out here because I'm supporting my two moms and
hope, family, right?
Yeah, and my family.
For our kids, just with being able to have equal benefits, access to Social Security, if something were to happen to my wife, to be able to provide more for my kids, it would just make so much more sense for us and would help them kind of understand the world and that they're not any different. You know, our family's no different from anybody else.
This part right now is for that young brother or that young sister who is gay and lesbian and couldn't take it no more. And they took their lives. This is for that young brother and that young sister who's queer, who was afraid to tell their mama or their daddy that they wanted to marry somebody who they love. This is for that young person or that old person who's been dealing with this and had to go to their family and sit everybody down and tell them that I love this person and I want to be with this person for the rest of my life. This is for them.
You just heard the voices of Faye Jacobs, Anna Olson, Nicole Connolly, David Wilson, Madison Kennedy, Zach Kennedy, Christy Kennedy, and the Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr., who rallied outside the U.S. Supreme Court. This segment was recorded and produced by FSRN's Anna Simonton. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.